The Weapon Shops of Isher by A.E. Van Vogt. Copyright 1951 by Greenberg Incorporated. Narrated by Bruce Hunty.
This book was originally created for audio cassette playback. Any announcements concerning cassettes do not apply to this recording. This version contains markers allowing direct access to major portions of the book.
Annotation. In the year 4785, the tyrant Empress Inelda of Isher is determined to destroy the weapon shops to gain total control of the universe. Her scientists mount a formidable attack on the shops, and only the accidental arrival of a man from the 20th century keeps the weapon shops from crumbling. From the book jacket. The right to bear arms is the right to be free. In the year 4785, tremendous knowledge has enabled Empress Inelda of Isher to rule the entire universe. Only one institution obstructs her total control, the weapon shops. The shops arm and defend the free people against their willful ruler, but her scientists have devised formidable weaponry to answer the threat to her rule. The shops are just about to crumble when a visitor arrives. A man from the 20th century, thrown across a vast time warp, a man in possession of a force capable of total destruction, a force that could forge the chains of universal tyranny or break them. An astounding adventure hurls you through the same universe as Van Vogt's The Weapon Makers. Other books by A.E. Van Vogt. The House That Stood Still. The Mind Cage. Mission to the Stars. Renaissance. The Universe Maker. The Violent Man. Prologue. 1. Magician believed to have hypnotized crowd. June 11th, 1951. Police and newspapermen believe that Middle City will shortly be advertised as the next stopping place of a master magician, and they are prepared to extend him a hearty welcome if he will condescend to explain exactly how he fooled hundreds of people into believing they saw a strange building, apparently a kind of gun shop. The building seemed to appear on the space formerly and still occupied by Aunt Sally's Lunch and Patterson Taylor's. Only employees were inside the two aforementioned shops, and none noticed any untoward event. A large, brightly shining sign featured the front of the gun shop, which had been so miraculously conjured out of nothingness, and the sign constituted the first evidence that the entire scene was nothing but a masterly illusion. For from whichever angle one gazed at it, one seemed to be staring straight at the words, which read, "Fine weapons. The right to buy weapons is the right to be free." The window display was made up of an assortment of rather curiously shaped guns, rifles, as well as small arms, and a glowing sign in the window stated, "The finest energy weapons in the known universe." Inspector Clayton of the investigation branch attempted to enter the shop, but the door seemed to be locked. A few moments later, C.J. Chris McAllister, reporter of the Gazette Bulletin, tried the door, found that it opened, and entered. Inspector Clayton attempted to follow him, but discovered that the door was again locked. It is believed that McAllister went through to the back, as several spectators reported seeing him. Immediately after his reappearance, the strange building vanished as abruptly as it had appeared. Police state they are baffled as to how the master magician created so detailed an illusion for so long a period before so large a crowd. They are prepared to recommend his show when it comes without reservations. Author's note. The foregoing account did not mention that the police, dissatisfied with the affair, attempted to contact McAllister for a further interview, but were unable to locate him. Weeks have passed, and he has still not been found. What did happen to McAllister from the instant that he found the door of the gun shop unlocked? There was a curious quality about the gun shop door. It was not so much that it opened at his first touch as that, when he pulled, it came away like a weightless thing. McAllister had the impression that the knob had freed itself into his palm. He stood very still, startled. The thought that came finally had to do with Inspector Clayton, who a minute earlier had found the door locked. The thought was like a signal. From behind him boomed the voice of the inspector. "I'm McAllister, I'll handle this now." It was dark inside the shop beyond the door, too dark to see anything, and somehow his eyes wouldn't accustom themselves to the intense gloom. Pure reporter's instinct made him step forward toward the blackness that pressed from beyond the rectangle of door. Out of the corner of one eye, he saw Inspector Clayton's hand reaching for the door handle that his own fingers had let go a moment before. And he knew instantly that if the inspector could prevent it, no reporter would get inside that building. His head was still turned, his gaze more on the police officer than on the darkness in front. And it was as he began another step forward that the remarkable thing happened. The door handle would not allow Inspector Clayton to touch it. It twisted in some queer way, in some energy way, for it was still there, a strange, blurred shape. The door itself, without visible movement, it was so swift, was suddenly touching McAllister's heel. Light, almost weightless, was that touch. And then, before he could think or react to what had happened, the momentum of his forward movement had carried him inside. As he breasted the darkness, there was a sudden agonized tensing along his nerves. Then the door shut tight. The brief, unexpected agony faded. Ahead was a brightly lit shop. Behind were unbelievable things. For McAllister, the moment that followed was one of blank impression. He stood, body twisted awkwardly, only vaguely conscious of the shop's interior, but tremendously aware, in the brief moment before he was interrupted, of what lay beyond the transparent panels of the door through which he had just come. There was no unyielding blackness anywhere, no Inspector Clayton, no muttering crowd of gaping spectators, no dingy row of shops across the way. It was not even the same street. There was no street. Instead, a peaceful park was visible. Beyond it, brilliant under a noon sun, was the skyline of a vast city. From behind him, a husky, musical woman's voice said, "You will be wanting a gun?" McAllister turned. The movement was automatic reaction to a sound. And because the affair was still like a dream, the city scene faded almost instantly. His mind focused on the young woman who was advancing slowly from the rear section of the store. Briefly, his thought wouldn't come clear. A conviction that he ought to say something was tangled with first impressions of the girl's appearance. She had a slender, well-shaped body. Her face was creased with a pleasant smile. She had brown eyes and wavy brown hair. Her simple frock and sandals seemed so normal at first glance that he gave them no further thought. He was able to say, "What I can't understand is why the police officer who tried to follow me couldn't get in. And where is he now?" To his surprise, the girl's smile became faintly apologetic. "We know that people consider it silly of us to keep harping on that ancient feud." Her voice grew firmer. "We even know how clever the propaganda is that stresses the silliness of our stand. Meanwhile, we never allow any of her men in here. We continue to take our principles very seriously." She paused as if she expected comprehension from him. But McAllister saw from the slow puzzlement creeping into her eyes that his face must look as blank as the thoughts behind it. Her men. The girl had spoken the words as if she were referring to some personage, and in direct reply to his use of the word police officer. That meant her men, whoever she was, were policemen, and they weren't allowed in this gun shop. So the door was hostile and wouldn't admit them. An emptiness struck into McAllister's mind, matching the hollowness that was beginning to afflict the pit of his stomach. A sense of unplumbed depths, the first staggering conviction that all was not as it should be. The girl was speaking in a sharper tone.
"You mean you know nothing of all this? That for generations the Gunmakers Guild has existed in this age of devastating energies as the common man's only protection against enslavement? The right to buy guns..."
She stopped, her narrowed eyes searching him. Then,
"Come to think of it, there's something very peculiar about you. Your outlandish clothes. You're not from the northern farm plains, are you?"
He shook his head dumbly, more annoyed with his reactions every passing second. But he couldn't help it. A tightness was growing in him now, becoming more unbearable instant by instant, as if somewhere a vital mainspring was being wound to the breaking point. The young woman went on more swiftly.
"And come to think of it, it is as astounding that a policeman should have tried the door and there was no alarm."
Her hand moved. Metal flashed in it, metal as bright as steel in blinding sunlight. There was not the slightest hint of an apology in her voice as she said,
"You will stay where you are, sir, until I have called my father. In our business, with our responsibilities, we never take chances. Something is very wrong here.
Curiously, it was at this point that McAllister's mind began to function clearly. The thought that came paralleled hers. How had this gun shop appeared on a 1951 street? How had he come here into this fantastic world? Something was very wrong indeed. It was the gun that held his attention. It was a tiny thing, shaped like a pistol, but with three cubes projecting in a half circle from the top of the slightly bulbous firing chamber. He began to feel shaken looking at it, for that wicked little instrument, glittering there in her brown fingers, was as real as herself.
"Good heaven," he whispered. "What the devil kind of a gun is it? Lower that thing and let's try to find out what all this is about."
She seemed not to be listening. He noticed that her gaze was flicking to a point on the wall somewhat to his left. He followed her look in time to see seven miniature white lights flash on. Curious lights. He was fascinated by the play of light and shade, the waxing and waning from one tiny globe to the next, a rippling movement of infinitesimal increments and decrements, an incredibly delicate effect of instantaneous reaction to some supersensitive barometer. The light steadied. His gaze reverted to the girl. To his surprise, she was putting away her gun. She must have noticed his expression.
"It's all right," she said coolly. "The automatics are on you now. If we're wrong about you, we'll be glad to apologize. Meanwhile, if you're still interested in buying a gun, I'll be happy to demonstrate."
So the automatics were on him, McAllister thought. He felt no relief at the information. Whatever the automatics were, they wouldn't be working in his favor. The young woman putting away her gun, in spite of her suspicions, spoke volumes for the efficiency of the new watchdogs. He'd have to get out of this place, of course. Meanwhile, the girl was assuming that a man who came into a gun shop would, under ordinary circumstances, want to buy a gun. It struck him suddenly that of all the things he could think of, what he most wanted to see was one of those strange guns. There were incredible implications in the very shape of the instruments. Aloud, he said, "Yes, by all means, show me." A thought occurred to him. He added, "I have no doubt your father is somewhere in the background making some sort of study of me." The young woman made no move to bring out any weapons. Instead, she stared at him in puzzlement.
"You may not realize it," she said slowly, "but you have already upset our entire establishment. The lights of the automatic should have gone on the moment Father pressed the buttons, as he did when I called him. They didn't. That's unnatural, and yet..."
Her frown deepened.
"If you were one of them, how did you get through that door? Is it possible that her scientists have discovered human beings who do not affect the sensitive energies? And that you were but one of many such, sent as an experiment to determine whether or not entrance could be gained? Yet that isn't logical either. If they had even a hope of success, they wouldn't risk the chance of throwing away an overwhelming surprise. In that case, you would be the entering wedge of an attack on a vast scale. She is ruthless, she's brilliant, and she craves complete power over poor fools like you, who have no more sense than to worship her and the splendor of the imperial court."
The young woman paused with the faintest of smiles.
"There I go again, making a political speech. But you can see that there are at least a few reasons why we should be careful about you."
There was a chair in one corner. McAllister started for it. His mind was calmer. "Look," he began, "I don't know what you're talking about. I don't even know how I came to be in this shop. I agree with you that the whole thing requires explanation, but I mean that differently than you do." His voice trailed. He had been half lowered over the chair, but instead of sinking into it, he came erect, slowly, like an old, old man, his eyes fixed on lettering that shone above a glass case of guns behind her. He said hoarsely,
"Is that a calendar?"
She followed his gaze, puzzled.
"Yes, it's June 3rd. What's wrong?"
"I don't mean that. I mean..." He caught himself with an effort. "I mean those figures above that. I mean, what year is this?" The girl looked surprised. She started to say something, then stopped and backed away. Finally,
"Don't look like that. There's nothing wrong. This is 84 of the 4,700th year of the Imperial House of Isher. It's quite all right."
2. Very deliberately, McAllister sat down, and the conscious wonder came. Exactly how should he feel? Not even surprise came to his aid. The events were beginning to fall into a kind of distorted pattern. The building front superimposed on those two 1951 shops. The way the door had acted. The great exterior sign with its odd linking of freedom with the right to buy weapons. The actual display of weapons in the window, the finest energy weapons in the known universe. He grew aware that the girl was talking earnestly with a tall, gray-haired man who was standing on the threshold of the door through which she had originally come. There was a tenseness in the way they were talking. Their low-spoken words made a blur of sound in his ears, strange and unsettling. McAllister could not quite analyze the meaning of it until the girl turned and said, "What is your name?" McAllister gave it. The girl hesitated, then, "Mr. McAllister, my father wants to know what year you're from." The gray-haired man stepped forward. "I'm afraid," he said gravely, "that there is no time to explain. What has happened is what we gunmakers have feared for generations, that once again would come one who lusted for unlimited power, and who, to attain tyranny, must necessarily seek first to destroy us. Your presence here is a manifestation of the energy force that she has turned against us, something so new that we did not even suspect it was being used against us. But I have no time to waste. Get all the information you can, Lystra, and warn him of his own personal danger." The man turned. The door closed noiselessly behind his tall figure. McAllister asked, "What did he mean, personal danger?" He saw the girl's brown eyes were uneasy as they rested on him. "It's hard to explain," she began in an uncomfortable voice. "First of all, come to the window, and I'll try to make everything clear. It's all very confusing to you, I suppose." McAllister drew a deep breath. "Now we're getting somewhere." His alarm was gone. The gray-haired man seemed to know what it was all about. That meant there should be no difficulty getting home again. As for all this danger to the Gunmakers Guild, that was their worry, not his. He stepped forward, closer to the girl. To his amazement, she cringed away as if he had threatened her. As he stared blankly, she laughed humorlessly, and finally she said, "Don't think I'm being silly. Don't be offended. But for your life's sake, don't touch any human body you might come in contact with." McAllister was conscious of a chill. Then suddenly he felt a surge of impatience at the fear that showed in the girl's face. "Now look," he began, "I want to get things clear. We can talk here without danger, providing I don't touch or come near you. Is that right?" She nodded. "The floor, the walls, every piece of furniture. In fact, the entire shop is made of non-conducting material." McAllister had a sense of being balanced on a tightrope over a bottomless abyss. He forced calm onto his mind. "Let's start," he said, "at the beginning. How did you and your father know that I was not of..." He paused before the odd phrase, then went on. "Of this time." "Father photographed you," the girl said. "He photographed the contents of your pockets. That was how he first found out what was the matter. You see, the sensitive energies themselves become carriers of the energy with which you're charged. That's what was wrong. That's why the automatics wouldn't focus on you and..."
"Energy? Charged?" said McAllister. The girl was staring at him.
"Don't you understand?" she gasped. "You've come across 7,000 years of time. And of all the energies in the universe, time is the most potent. You're charged with trillions of time energy units. If you should step outside this shop, you'd blow up Imperial City and 50 miles of land beyond. You..."
She finished on an unsteady upward surge of her voice.
"You could conceivably destroy the Earth."
3. He hadn't noticed the mirror before. Funny, too, because it was large enough, at least 8 feet high, and directly in front of him on the wall, where, a minute before, he could have sworn, had been solid metal.
"Look at yourself," the girl was saying soothingly. "There's nothing so steadying as one's own image. Actually, your body is taking the metal shock very well."
He stared at his image. There was a paleness in the lean face that stared back at him. But his body was not actually shaking, as the whirling in his mind had suggested. He grew aware again of the girl. She was standing with a finger on one of a series of wall switches. Abruptly, he felt better. "Thank you," he said quietly. "I certainly needed that." She smiled encouragingly. Andy was able now to be amazed at her conflicting personality. There had been, on the one hand, her inability a few minutes earlier to get to the point of the danger, an incapacity for explaining things with words. Yet, obviously, her action with the mirror showed a keen understanding of human psychology. He said, "The problem now is, from your point of view, to circumvent this Isher woman and get me back to 1951 before I blow up the earth of whatever year this is." The girl nodded.
"Father says that you can be sent back, but as for the rest, watch."
He had no time for relief at the knowledge that he could be returned to his own time. She pressed another button. Instantly, the mirror was gone into metallic wall. Another button clicked. The wall vanished. Before him stretched a park similar to the one he had already seen through the front door, obviously an extension of the same garden-like vista. Trees were there, and flowers, and green grass in the sun. One vast building, as high as it was long, towered massively dark against the sky and dominated the entire horizon. It was a good quarter mile away, and incredibly, it was at least that long and that high. Neither near that monstrous building nor in the park was a living person visible. Everywhere was evidence of man's dynamic labor, but no men, no movement. Even the trees stood motionless in that breathless, sunlit day.
"Watch," said the girl again, more softly.
There was no click this time. She made an adjustment on one of the buttons, and the view was no longer so clear. It wasn't that the sun had dimmed its bright intensity. It wasn't even that glass was visible where a moment before there had been nothing. There was still no apparent substance between them and that gem-like park. But the park was no longer deserted. Scores of men and machines swarmed out there. McAllister stared in amazement. And then, as the sense of illusion faded and the dark menace of those men penetrated, his emotion changed to dismay.
"Why," he said at last, "those men are soldiers, and the machines are..." "Energy guns," she said. "That's always been their problem, how to get their weapons close enough to our shops to destroy us. It isn't that the guns are now powerful over a very great distance. Even the rifles we sell can kill unprotected life over a distance of miles. But our gun shops are so heavily fortified that to destroy us, they must use their biggest cannon at point-blank range. In the past, they could never do that because we own the surrounding park, and our alarm system was perfect. Until now, the new energy they're using affects none of our protective instruments. And what is infinitely worse, affords them a perfect shield against our own guns. Invisibility, of course, has long been known. But if you hadn't come, we would have been destroyed without ever knowing what happened."
"But," McAllister exclaimed sharply, "what are you going to do? They're still out there, working." Her brown eyes burned with the fierce yellow flame.
"My father has warned the Guild, and individual members have now discovered that similar invisible guns are being set up by invisible men outside their shops. The Council will meet shortly to discuss defenses."
Silently, McAllister watched the soldiers connecting what must have been invisible cables that led to the vast buildings in the background, foot-thick cables that told of the titanic power that was to be unleashed on the tiny weapon shop. There was nothing to be said. The reality out there overshadowed sentences and phrases. Of all the people here, he was the most useless, his opinion the least worthwhile. He must have said so. But he did not realize that until the familiar voice of the girl's father came from one side of him.
"You're quite mistaken, Mr. McAllister. Of all the people here, you are the most valuable. Through you, we discovered that the Isher were actually attacking us. Furthermore, our enemies do not know of your existence, therefore have not yet realized the full effect produced by the new blanketing energy they have used. You, accordingly, constitute the unknown factor. We must make immediate use of you."
The man looked older, McAllister thought. There were lines of strain in his lean, sallow face as he turned to his daughter, and his voice, when he spoke, was edged with sharpness.
"Lystra, number 7.
As the girl's fingers touched the 7th button, her father explained swiftly to McAllister,
"The Guild Supreme Council is holding an immediate emergency session. We must choose the most likely method of attacking the problem and concentrate individually and collectively on that method. Regional conversations are already in progress, but only one important idea has been put forward as yet, and... Ah, gentlemen!"
He spoke past McAllister, who turned with a start. Men were coming out of the solid wall, lightly, easily, as if it were a door and they were stepping across a threshold. 1, 2, 3, 30. They were grim-faced men, all except one, who glanced at McAllister, started to walk past, and then stopped with a half-amused smile. "Don't look so blank. How else do you think we could have survived these many years if we hadn't been able to transmit material objects through space? The Isher police have always been only too eager to blockade our sources of supply. Incidentally, my name is Cadran, Peter Cadran."
McAllister nodded in a perfunctory manner. He was no longer genuinely impressed by the new machines. Here were the end products of the machine age, science and invention so advanced that men made scarcely a move that did not affect or was not affected by a machine. A heavy-faced man near him said, "We have gathered here because it is obvious that the source of the new energy is the great building just outside this shop." He motioned toward the wall, which had been a mirror, and then the window through which McAllister had gazed at the monstrous structure in question. The speaker went on. "We've known ever since the building was completed 5 years ago that it was a power building aimed against us. And now, from it, new energy has flown out to engulf the world. Immensely potent energy, so strong that it broke the very tensions of time, fortunately only at this nearest gun shop. Apparently, it weakens when transmitted over distance."
"Look, Dressley," came a curt interruption from a small, thin man. "What good is all this preamble? You have been examining the various plans put forward by regional groups. Is there or isn't there a decent one among them?"
Dressley hesitated. To McAllister's surprise, the man's eyes fixed doubtfully on him. His heavy face worked for a moment, then hardened. "Yes, there is a method, but it depends on compelling our friend from the past to take a great risk. You all know what I am referring to. It will gain us the time we need."
"Eh?"
said McAllister, and stood stunned as all eyes turned to stare at him. 4. It struck McAllister that what he needed again was the mirror to prove to himself that his body was putting up a good front. His gaze flicked over the faces of the men. The gunmakers made a confusing pattern in the way they sat or stood or leaned against glass cases of shining guns. And there seemed to be fewer than he had previously counted. 1, 2, 28, including the girl. He could have sworn there had been 32. His eyes moved on just in time to see the door of the back room closing. 4 of the men had gone to whatever lay beyond that door. He shook his head, puzzled, and then, consciously drawing his attention back, stared thoughtfully at the faces before him. He said, "I can't understand how any one of you could even think of compulsion. According to you, I'm loaded with energy. I may be wrong, but if any of you should try to thrust me back down the chute of time, or even touch me, that energy in me would do devastating things."
"You're damned right," chimed in a young man. He barked irritably at Dressley. "How the devil did you ever come to make such a psychological blunder? You know that McAllister will have to do as we want to save himself, and he'll have to do it fast."
Dressley grunted. "Hell," he said. "The truth is that we have no time to waste in explanation, and I just figured that he might scare easily. I see, however, that we're dealing with an intelligent man." McAllister's eyes narrowed over the group. This was phony. He said sharply, "And don't give me any soft soap about being intelligent. You fellows are sweating blood. You'd shoot your own grandmothers and trick me into the bargain because the world you think right is at stake. What's this plan of yours that you were going to compel me to participate in?" It was the young man who replied. "You are to be given insulated clothes and sent back to your own time." He paused. McAllister said, "That sounds okay so far. What's the catch?"
"There is no catch."
McAllister stared. "Now look here," he began. "Don't give me any of that. If it's as simple as that, how the devil am I going to be helping you against the Isher energy?" The young man scowled blackly at Dressley. "You see," he said, "you've made him suspicious with that talk of yours about compulsion." He faced McAllister. "What we have in mind is an application of a sort of an energy lever and fulcrum principle. You are to be the weight at the long end of a kind of energy crowbar, which lifts the greater weight at the short end. You will go back 5,000 years in time. The machine in the great building to which your body is tuned
and which has caused all this trouble, will move ahead in time several months.
In that way, interrupted another man before McAllister could speak, we should have time to find another counteragent. There must be a solution, else our enemies would not have acted so secretly. Well, what do you think?
McAllister walked slowly over to the chair that he had occupied previously. His mind was turning at furious speed, but he knew with a grim foreboding that he hadn't the technical knowledge necessary to safeguard himself. He said slowly, "As I see it, this is supposed to work something like a pump handle. The lever principle, the old idea that if you had a lever long enough and a suitable fulcrum, you could move the Earth out of its orbit."
"Exactly." It was the heavy-faced Dressley who spoke. "Only this works in time. You go 5,000 years, the building goes..."
His voice faded, his eagerness drained from him as he caught the expression in McAllister's face.
"Look," said McAllister, "there's nothing more pitiful than a bunch of honest men engaged in an act of dishonesty. You're strong men, the intellectual type, who've spent your lives enforcing an idealistic conception. You've always told yourselves that if the occasion should ever require it, you would not hesitate to make drastic sacrifices. But you're not fooling anybody. What's the catch?"
5.
It was startling to have the suit thrust at him. He had noticed the men emerge from the back room, and it came as a shock to realize that they had gone for the insulated clothes before they could have known that he would use them.
McAllister stared grimly at Peter Cadran, who held the dull, grayish, limp thing toward him, and said in a tight voice,
"Get into this and get going. It's a matter of minutes, man. When those guns out there start spraying energy, you won't be alive to argue about our honesty."
Still, he hesitated. The room seemed insufferably hot. Perspiration streaked down his cheeks, and he felt sick with uncertainty. Somewhere in the background, a man was saying,
"Our first purpose must be to gain time. Then we must establish new shops in communities where they cannot be easily attacked. Simultaneously, we must contact every Imperial potential who can help us directly or indirectly. And finally, we must..."
The voice went on, but McAllister heard no more. His frantic gaze fell on the girl, standing silent and subdued near the front door. He strode toward her, and either his glare or presence was frightening, for she cringed and turned white.
"Look," he said, "I'm in this as deep as hell. What's the risk in this thing? I've got to feel that I have some chance. Tell me, what's the catch?"
The girl was gray now, almost as gray and dead-looking as the suit Peter Cadran was holding.
"It's the friction," she mumbled finally. "You may not get all the way back to 1951. You see, you'll be a sort of weight, and..."
McAllister whirled away from her. He climbed into the soft, almost flimsy suit, crowding the overall-like shape over his neatly pressed clothes.
"It comes tight over the head, doesn't it?"
"Yes."
It was Lystra's father who answered.
"As soon as you pull that zipper shut, the suit will become completely invisible. To outsiders, it will seem just as if you have your ordinary clothes on. The suit is fully equipped. You could live on the moon inside it."
"What I don't get," complained McAllister, "is why I have to wear it. I got here all right without it."
He frowned. His words had been automatic, but abruptly a thought came.
"Just a minute," he said. "What becomes of the energy with which I'm charged when I'm bottled up in this insulation?"
He saw by the stiffening expressions of those around him that he had touched on a vast subject.
"So that's it," he snapped. "The insulation is to prevent me losing any of that energy. That's how it can make a weight. I have no doubt there is a connection from this suit to that other machine. Well, it's not too late."
With a desperate twist, he tried to jerk aside, to evade the clutching hands of the four men who leaped at him. But they had him instantly, and their grips on him were strong beyond his power to break. The fingers of Peter Cadran jerked the zipper tight, and Peter Cadran said, "Sorry, but when we went into that back room, we also dressed in insulated clothing. That's why you couldn't hurt us. And remember this, there's no certainty that you are being sacrificed. The fact that there is no crater in our Earth proves that you did not explode in the past, and that you solved the problem in some other way. Now somebody open the door, quick!" Irresistibly, he was carried forward, and then...
"Wait!"
It was the girl. Her eyes glittered like dark jewels, and in her fingers was the tiny, mirror-bright gun she had pointed in the beginning at McAllister.
the little group hustling McAllister stopped as if they had been struck. He was scarcely aware. For him, there was only the girl, and the way the muscles of her lips were working, and the way her voice suddenly cried,
"This is utter outrage. Are we such cowards? Is it possible that the spirit of liberty can survive only through a shoddy act of murder and gross defiance of the rights of the individual?"
"I say no. Mr. McAllister must have the protection of the hypnotism treatment. Surely so brief a delay will not be fatal."
"Lystra."
It was her father, and McAllister realized by his swift movement how quickly the older man grasped every aspect of the situation. He stepped forward and took the gun from his daughter's fingers. The only man in the room, McAllister thought, who could dare approach her in that moment with the certainty she would not fire. For hysteria was in every line of her face, and the tears that followed showed how dangerous her stand might have been against the others. Strangely, not for a moment had hope come. The entire action seemed divorced from his life and his thought. There was only the observation of it. He stood there for a seeming eternity, and when emotion finally came, it was surprise that he was not being hustled to his doom. With the surprise came awareness that Peter Cadran had let go of his arm and stepped clear of him. The man's eyes were calm, his head held proudly erect. He said, "Your daughter is right, sir. At this point we rise above our fears, and we say to this unhappy young man, have courage, you will not be forgotten. We can guarantee nothing, cannot even state exactly what will happen to you. But we say, if it lies in our power to help you, that help you shall have. And now, we must protect you from the devastating psychological pressures that would otherwise destroy you, simply but effectively." Too late, McAllister noticed that the others had turned their faces away from that extraordinary wall, the wall that had already displayed so vast a versatility. He did not even see who pressed the activating button for what followed. There was a flash of dazzling light. For an instant, he felt as if his mind had been laid bare, and against that nakedness, the voice of Peter Cadran pressed like some engraving stamp. "To retain your self-control and your sanity, this is your hope. This you will do in spite of everything. And for your own sake, speak of your experience only to scientists or to those in authority whom you feel will understand and help. Good luck." So strong remained the effect of that brief flaring light that he felt only vaguely the touch of their hands on him, propelling him. He felt himself falling,